This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 9th of October, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we head to Singapore to attend the 5th World Architecture Festival.
Temporary structures, architectures, pavilions, they allow you quite a lot of freedom as an architect and as a designer, where you can actually push ideas and you can test them quite quickly.
We discuss the notion of ugly with author of a new book on the subject, Stephen Bailey.
This book is a sort of jeu d'esprit. It's not an academic book. You can't write an academic book because there are no other books on ugliness. It's a sort of intellectual entertainment. I just want people to ask questions. I mean, what is ugliness? What does it mean? What do we mean by it? You know, what are the conventions of beauty?
And we sit down with Arik Chen in Hong Kong to hear how his latest appointment will bring a welcome dose of design to the metropolis.
For me, the chance to kind of help build a museum and a permanent collection from scratch in a part of the world where these new narratives keep developing and old narratives are waiting to be rediscovered, it was just too much to pass up.
More on that in a bit. Plus, we meet legendary Italian designer Gaetano Pesce. We'll be finding out about a competition to design a 21st century souvenir for the city of Vienna. And we'll talk tangling, the Japanese architect Akihisa Hirata too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Section D on Monocle 24. The World Architecture Festival and Awards celebrated its 5th anniversary this year with a move from Barcelona, where the gathering had been held for the previous 4 years, to a new home in Singapore. Monocle's Singapore correspondent, Justin Bergman, dropped by to find out what the world's architects and urban planners were talking about and to find out which firm took home the rather gigantic accolade of World Building of the Year.
The Marina Bay Sands Convention Center was buzzing with conversation as the World Architecture Festival opened last week and the 1,800 delegates in attendance began exchanging business cards. As they chatted, many also perused the vendor booths selling materials like fast-setting cement, terracotta roof tiles, and bathroom fixtures.
Come with the two knobs. If you turn to the right, it goes to the rain shower. If you turn to the left, goes to the hand shower. Okay. It's aqua dimmer. Okay. You don't need an additional diverter. You
know, on the stage, meanwhile, the focus was on the latest innovations in the field. American architect Mark Foster Gage described, for instance, how the advances in 3D technology have made Rem Koolhaas's sketches from the 1980s look like a six-year-old's drawings. With the new technology, however, has come new challenges.
Part of what we have to determine with this 3D technology is where do we draw our boundaries? I just did an apartment in New York that every surface was highly textured. So we even CNC milled some floors so they have this like massage-like feel. And we found ourselves scanning this woman's knives because she was an avid chef and building 3D models of the knives so we could do a custom cutting board and allow her hand to reach down under the handle of each knife. And I find myself like, is this really the best use of my time in these technologies to make sure that she can grab the handle of this knife on this microscopic level on something that's never seen and spends 99% of his time inside a drawer? You don't know.
One of the more interesting presentations came from Pernilla Orstedt, the Swedish architect who teamed with Asif Khan to create a temporary musical structure for the London Olympics called the Coca-Cola Beatbox. She described how the idea of pop-up architecture was also gaining new currency in the field.
We had nearly 200,000 people that walked through the pavilion, so that's kind of more than a lot of permanent buildings get in many years. But at the same time, I think temporary structures, architectures, pavilions, they allow you quite a lot of freedom as an architect and as a designer, where you can actually push ideas and you can test them quite quickly. So I don't know, I feel like I want to keep that within my practice. Of course, like, I would like to do more and more permanent buildings. But I think what you learn from temporary fast projects is sort of invaluable.
Architects didn't just talk about their work at the festival. They were there to compete too. Prizes were awarded in some 24 categories, recognizing the best designs in everything from houses and offices to schools and transport structures. Each firm presented their designs to teams of judges throughout the day. Some were quite creative, such as the Brazilian firm MK27, which made a video showing a cat poking around its entrant in the villas category. MK27 didn't win, however. The award for best villa went to John Wardle's Shearer's Quarters, a small shearing shed on the southern coast of Tasmania. The structure, made of recycled apple boxes, replaced a centuries-old shearing shed that burned down in the 1980s.
We found a very old photo from 1940, when the old house was already 100 years old, and it showed the old wool shed, which is on this site that we've just built on. And it was part skillion and part gable, and we thought it'd be interesting to design a shed that had those as sort of primary idea, the two profiles of the two most predominant kinds of rural enclosure, the skillion and the gable. So it's almost like an argument between two people standing in a paddock identifying something. It's a skillion at one end and a gable at the other.
The grand prize for World Building of the Year went to the British firms Wilkinson Air and Grant Associates for the ambitious Gardens on the Bay project in Singapore.
It's a complex, it's the cool conservatories at Gardens by the Bay. Wilkinson Air Architects.
Built at a cost of $800 million, the garden features two giant glass conservatories and space-age super trees made of concrete and steel and covered in plant life. Paul Baker of Wilkinson Air Architects describes how the super trees were built.
They're around a central conical concrete core. They're a series of overlaying steel structures that cone up and then fan out at the top. They're held with a series of radial wires, which are virtually invisible, and they overlap. So they're a series of branch forms, and each of the steel tubes gets gradually smaller as it reaches its tip, like a kind of tree, basically.
And you draw inspiration from Singapore's foliage, the trees here?
Yeah, well, the super tree, rain trees are a pretty, you know, they're such an icon of Singapore. So partly that, but lots of other things, lots of amazing movies, a bit of Lord of the Rings, a bit of Studio Ghibli, lots of incredible creative thoughts, which have, you know, become a really nice, I think, a very strong image for the garden.
In Singapore, I'm Justin Bergman for Monocle.
And from the notion of beauty in architecture, we turn our attention to the other end of the spectrum now, ugliness. Many of us spend our lives in the pursuit of beauty, but have we been neglecting the value of ugliness? Cultural commentator and self-proclaimed obsessional aesthete Stephen Bailey challenges our perceptions of all things unattractive in his latest book, Ugly: The Aesthetics of Everything, which is out later this week. During the London Design Festival, Stephen charmed an audience with a sneak preview at the European Design Centre as part of the Fitzrovia Now design trail. He explained to Hazel Pfeiffer his fascination with imperfection.
I've got a professional, lifelong personal interest in design. I've always been interested in the appearance of things. In fact, I go so far as to say I'm obsessed by the appearance of things. I mean, I'm more interested in the appearance of things than anything else. I've always wanted to know what things mean, whether it's a building, a car, a woman, whatever. And I've always, even as a child, before I knew what aesthetics was, I'm not sure I know what aesthetics is now, but I've always wanted to hold up the material world to scrutiny. I've always wanted to ask questions about, you know, why do we admire the look of a Ferrari but not admire the look of a, shall we say, a Vauxhall or a Peugeot? I don't know. I was asking questions like that all the time. And then, of course, I became professionally involved with the whole world of design. And one of the great things which designers, or the whole design world, likes to talk about is, until recently it did, about how to democratize, you know, beauty. The whole thrust of 20th century design was how to make beauty universal. And this is a noble and fascinating idea, but as soon as you begin to examine it, you begin to ask questions. I mean, what is this idea of beauty? And if you begin to scrutinize the idea of beauty, you inevitably come around to the unspoken idea of ugliness. Now, ugliness is just absolutely fascinating, not least because no one's really, before my book, quite seriously, almost no one has bothered to address it. I mean, how do you cope with the idea? I mean, our civilization is based on notions of beauty, but how do you address ugliness? And, you know, this book is, it's a sort of jeu d'esprit. It's not an academic book. You can't write an academic book. There are no other books on ugliness. It's a sort of intellectual entertainment. I just want people to ask questions. I mean, what is ugliness? What does it mean? What do we mean by it? You know, what are the conventions of beauty? You know, we're always told things must be beautiful. We want to get more beautiful. You want to get a tan. I want to lose weight. We want to have a nicer house, a better car. We go to the gym. All these things to make ourselves more beautiful. But the fact is, if everything was beautiful, nothing would be. I mean, a world of beauty would be bland, uniform, and actually intolerable. Accept that idea, and it therefore follows that we need a little bit of ugliness. You need ugliness in order to excite the appetite for beauty. I mean, heaven needs hell. I mean, you can't have a concept of heaven unless you've got a concept of hell at the same time. But equally, accept that argument, and you have to accept the following proposition that, ask the following question, exactly how much ugliness do we need? I mean, should there be laws to promote ugliness? Should there be quotas? How do we promote ugliness? How do we create more? Because it's absolutely certain we need a certain ugliness in order to enjoy beauty.
How do we promote ugliness?
I don't know. That might be my next task. I was wondering whether at this stage of my career I might be promoted to be promoted to the House of Lords and become minister in charge of ugliness. This, I may be again displaying characteristics of psychiatric disorder here. But I find ugliness absolutely fascinating. And one of the things is, if you speak to students actually find it very difficult. If you're teaching a group of architecture students and you give them as a project, design an ugly building, actually very difficult to create ugliness deliberately. And that brings us back to that fascinating idea, which is a sort of commonplace. I mean, accident or design. I mean, ugliness tends to happen by accidental. It's caused by disease, it's caused by a calamity, it's caused by sort of carelessness. Ugliness is often not deliberate, whereas, of course, design is highly, highly self-conscious.
And we very much feed on this fear of ugliness. I mean, there's businesses making billions of dollars every year on trying to demonise ugliness.
But it's a very perplexing thing. I mean, the person who actually created the consultant design profession was a man called Raymond Loewy, who opened his first studio in New York in 1927. And Loewy made it his business to streamline fridges and add chrome here. It's magnificent. You know, the absolute synecdoche of the American dream. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And Raymond Loewy thought he was, making beauty available to the masses, which in a way he was. But what, of course, is significant was his great book, published in America and in 1951 in English, of course, was called Never Leave Well Enough Alone, the idea being that designers always want to tinker with things to change them, to make them more beautiful. However, more revealingly, when the French edition appeared a few years later, Loewy, who was a native Frenchman, a French speaker, the book was called Le Laideur se vend mal, Ugliness Sells Badly. And there you have one of the ideas which underwrites the whole of the modern movement in architecture and design. We want to avoid ugliness because people don't want to buy it.
So if beauty is homogenizing, then ugliness is difference.
Yeah. There's more variety. I believe there's more variety in ugliness. I mean, I think there's probably only one sort of beauty, perhaps. But I think ugliness is, it's one of the many ways in which ugliness could be, you could argue that ugliness is superior to beauty, because you can do it in so many ways. We get the word ugliness from the old Norse word ugga, which means aggressive. That's why we talk of an ugly customer, or an ugly noise. It's something which is intrusive and challenging. I love that line of Serge Gainsbourg, the French chanteur, crooner, who said ugliness is superior to beauty because it lasts longer. And it's true, beauty, the reason why beauty is so affecting and so tragic is because it's evanescent, it passes in people and places. And again, that's one of the other, I think, whether it's an important idea, it's certainly a fascinating one in the book, that one of the only things certain about human affairs is that our tastes change. What's conventionally regarded as beautiful in one generation, to be absolutely certain, is not regarded as beautiful in the next. It's worth asking this question. I mean, what are the conventions of beauty? What are the conventions of ugliness?
Do we need an ugly revolution?
I think we need to be more aware of it. I think what we don't want is complacency, because as I say, notions of beauty continuously change, but we wouldn't want the whole world to be beautiful, because that would be very, very boring.
That was our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer talking ugliness to author Stephen Bailey there. And on the topic of ugliness, this is one of my favourite songs on the subject. This is Unpretty by TLC.
to be so cute to me? Just a little bit skinny. Why do I look to all these things to keep you happy? Maybe get rid of you.
That was, of course, Unpretty by TLC. You can ponder the topic of ugliness a little further now as we take a short break. But do stick around. We'll be hearing how Vienna might update its cultural souvenirs from schnitzel and Sackertort after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, what springs to mind when you think of Vienna? Schnitzel, Mozart, imperial cafes, heaving with fur-clad ladies, gorging on Sackertort, perhaps. Vienna's tourist board is worried that our image of the city is old-fashioned and doesn't reflect the modern and creative centre that it's become. Rather than launching a series of glitzy brochures or television ads, they've organised a competition involving six renowned European designers. Their aim is to establish a new souvenir for Vienna for the 21st century. Monocle's James Pearson went along to the unveiling of the UK's entry to find out what exactly a 21st century souvenir for Vienna might look like.
It's a city so great they named a waltz after it. Few capitals can match Vienna for its past, the centre of a European empire and a meeting place for great minds. But in an age of mass tourism, Austria's capital faces competition from more international destinations than ever before. Norbert Kettner is the managing director of Vienna's tourist board. He's concerned that Vienna's image is out of date.
The image is still more old-fashioned than the reality, I would say. What we see very often is when people come to Vienna for the first time, they say, oh, we knew that you are historic, that you are beautiful and everything, but we didn't know that you are so contemporary and so modern and so vibrant. The most important thing is still the imperial heritage and the cultural life. Everybody knows the Habsburg era, and psychoanalysis is very important. Big cultural life in general for classic, but also for modern. And the thing which distinguishes us the most from other metropolis is the way of life. I would say that Vienna is combining a Northern European efficiency with perfect infrastructure, perfect public transport, with Southern European lifestyle. And there's one specific thing for city tourists. People who are coming to cities, they don't want to experience touristy things. They want to experience things people living there experience every day.
It's this need to show the world Vienna's a modern, inclusive destination that's prompted Norbert to select six cutting-edge designers to create a 21st century souvenir. Deliberately, all are from outside Austria.
To make your city more international, more multicultural is the best way to put a metropolis of the 21st century on the shelf, on the landscape, and that's what we're trying to do. It's always good to look outside, and Vienna is a big city in a small country. That's why small countries always have to look outside. And we were really curious how other European nations see us nowadays.
So, what does Europe think of Vienna?
Ladies and gentlemen, one could say, why are you even dealing with new design? Just remain in your past with your emperors, with your Lipizzaner horses.
I've come to the launch night of one of the prospective souvenirs, created by UK-based designers Pearson Lloyd. They've called their design a confluence of ideas, and it's based on one of Vienna's timeless institutions, the coffee house. I asked Tom Lloyd and Luke Pearson what inspiration they'd look for in designing their product.
we had to look for the DNA of the city of Vienna and represent it. And often when we, in any relationship we have with a, with another form of client, we're doing a similar kind of thing. Obviously, a city is, as an organism, is a very unique challenge. And so having never done it before, it was an exciting thing to do. I was immediately drawn to the idea of people, you know, Freud, Egon Schiele, the actual people who created, who were a part of their history. And actually, having gone around this whole idea of could it be architecture, we came back to the people. Because even though we've created something directly about coffee, the root of the idea is that actually this is where the coffee houses is where the ideas that made Vienna were created. And it's also where the ideas of Vienna will be created in the future.
Luke, could you just explain to me what we've got here, how you went about choosing this design? Is it a completely new product or is it a reinterpretation of something you've seen in a Viennese coffee house?
It's definitely a reinterpretation of what we've seen in the coffee house in terms of you have the coffee cup, you have the sugar bowl, the glass, the spoon, the tray. But I think it represents, not only does it represent sort of this incredible city life in terms of meeting in the coffee house, as Norbert's saying, you know, they're very special places. It's almost guaranteed when you go to Vienna that you'll experience this. We wanted to sort of collect that memory, but at the same time, within the actual functional objects themselves is also a reference to the industry, the fine industry that takes place in and around the city in terms of glass making, porcelain and fine metalwork. So there are also references to, in a way, the sort of industrial finesse that's also in the city and the surrounding area. So we hope in a way they reference historical craft and art traditions, but also a very contemporary culture, which is that of meeting in coffee houses.
For both Tom and Luke, what elevates a souvenir above a normal object is its ability to stimulate a memory or a past experience. Unlike snow globes or beer tankards or other kitsch items, this coffee set has a function and a time-honored process that's the same whether you're in Vienna or in your kitchen at home.
It should take you back to the place, to the experience you had when you were there. I mean, sometimes you receive it as a gift from someone who was there, and you were never there yourself. So you actually have to do two things. You have to kind of create the sensation and express the uniqueness of that place. And then you need to take people back to that place every time they look at it or use it.
So it's about a memory of what you've done in a coffee house in Vienna. You take this home with you and you go through the same process again.
Exactly. And so from that perspective, it's as an idea, it's very transferable.
The tray can be sold on its own, or it can be sold with the cup and the sugar bowl and the glass and the spoon. The reason for that is that actually you only need to put your own favourite objects from home onto the tray, and suddenly though it becomes a part of your daily life. So even though the tray on its own is quite a kind of discrete object, but that becomes very practical. And so just placing your favourite coffee cup or your favourite glass that you might have bought in another city also adds to the sense that it's woven into your sort of cultural life.
And that reflects in a very nice way also a more recent development in Viennese design. And we were talking about ornaments. Josef Franki was one of the most important designers and architects of the 20s, because he always said, okay, I make a frame, but you fill it up. As Tom mentioned, you can have the tray and put your objects on it. And I think this is a very nice approach. You know, when we talk about decorative design, it's always an icon, you know. You put something in your apartment and you hope that people will say, oh, what a modern guy. But I like if you can add a sort of personal touch to it as well. And then it really shows about your personality.
That was James Pearson reporting there on a competition to design a new 21st century souvenir for Vienna. And from the wide, open, imperial streets of the Austrian capital, we're off to the crowded alleys and shiny skyscrapers of Hong Kong next. The city is steaming ahead with its grand plan for the West Kowloon Cultural District. By 2017, the city will have a huge waterfront cultural precinct. The star of the show will be M+, the museum that promises to finally bring a high-quality museum experience to Hong Kong and the region. Eric Chen was recently announced as the design and architecture curator for M+, and our Hong Kong bureau chief, Liv Lewicznik, sat down with him to hear what he has up his sleeves.
Frankly, it was an offer I couldn't refuse. I mean, for me, the chance to kind of help build a museum and a permanent collection from scratch in a part of the world where these new narratives keep developing and old narratives are waiting to be rediscovered, it was just too much to pass up. I mean, I've always been interested in kind of snooping around and seeing what's out there, often sort of more on the edges. And now to be given the chance to kind of think about this edge here, but this edge which is increasingly becoming central in this multipolar world that we're seeing developing, it was just fantastic.
Yeah. Are you nervous at all? Because it's a very ambitious, big project. You have a lot on your shoulders and a lot of people will be counting on you to pull this off. Are you nervous?
Well, you know, like they say, one day at a time. I think if you do think of the size, scale, and scope of the project, it does seem a bit daunting. But we have like really great support, and I think people seem to be on board that this is a good thing to do, and so we'll just have to do it.
If you could just briefly just explain to our listeners the scope of the project and what it actually is.
M Plus is actually a centerpiece of the 41-hectare West Kowloon Cultural District, which will be built on the Victoria Harbour waterfront in Kowloon in Hong Kong. The museum itself will be a museum for visual culture under Lars Nitve, who was the first director of the Tate Modern and who's fantastic. And we're just starting the competition for the building now. It'll be about 60,000 square meters, which is about the size of MoMA in New York, just to give people a sense. And programmatically, it'll be a museum for visual culture. Now, how do we define visual culture? Primarily here in terms of art, design, architecture, and moving image. And beyond that, I think we do want to tell these stories from our perspective, which is a perspective in Hong Kong, in the Greater Asia region.
I know that it's obviously early days, but what's your vision? Do you have one already for what you want to bring to M+?
I think it's about sort of, on the one hand, telling the untold and not often told stories of design in Asia, Hong Kong, China, Japan, Korea, and beyond, really. Covering the range of design disciplines, you know, graphic, product, industrial design, architecture, fashion, textiles. But I think, on the other hand, what are we telling these stories for? I mean, of course, I believe there's inherent value in having a deeper understanding of design and how it has evolved over the past decades, maybe even up to a century here. But I think we can use what we know of the past and what we will learn of the past in order to help push things forward into the future. You think of the value of museums in the West, and of course there's a huge public and cultural value, but they've also been hugely influential for designers and artists and others who've been inspired, taken cues from, built upon, and perhaps reacted against the stories that they've seen in museums. And that's been a great benefit to the places where these museums have been, and we hope we can have serve that purpose here as well.
But how difficult or easy is it to start out with a clean slate? I mean, you're starting out in Hong Kong where there hasn't been a museum of this kind and people have been waiting for it, of course, for years. What kind of a challenge does that pose?
Frankly, I don't think there's been a museum of this kind anywhere in Asia, not just Hong Kong. And that makes it a very exciting opportunity, but of course also a daunting one, a challenging one, because we are talking about something of a tabula rasa in terms of presenting this kind of material in a consistent way. Especially for design and architecture, we've really got to go out there and talk to people who do know, and then try and take what they know and learn some things on our own and build and put it all together into a narrative of some sort. I think that will take time. You know, people ask me when will the museum be open. Well, the building will be doing programming in the meantime, but the building will open in 2017, at the end of 2017. And the joke is always, you know, well, just what are you going to do for the next 5 years? You know, nice job. But in fact, I think 5 years really is not much time to accomplish what we need to accomplish.
What sort of lessons do you bring with you from Beijing Design Week?
I've learned a lot. I mean, I'd say the main lesson that I learned from there that can be applied here is that there really is no shortage of smart, talented, dedicated, passionate, hardworking people here in the creative world, in the design and architecture and related fields. The problem, I think, is largely systemic and infrastructural. And so what we tried to do with Beijing Design Week was to build this open platform that created a better environment for designers and architects and so on. I think to some extent we've succeeded despite the odds, and I hope we can apply some of those lessons here to Hong Kong. And I think what Hong Kong's doing is amazing, with not just M Plus and West Kowloon, but this entire ecosystem, this cultural ecosystem that the city is developing, with nonprofit organizations and government agencies and private initiatives sort of popping up all throughout the city. And I think that's fantastic, and it bodes well for the future of creativity here. I don't know of any other city, certainly in this part of the world, and probably, you know, beyond that too, that has this kind of ambition right now, and is doing everything in such a thoughtful, kind of integrated, holistic sort of way. Of course, I imagine there have been and will continue to be lots of bumps in the road, but one thing that's for certain is that the energy and the motivation and the process seems to be going in the right direction here, and I don't see a reason to be anything but optimistic.
Actually, I just wanted to ask one last question about Beijing Design Week. So what's happening this year? What can we expect?
Yeah, Beijing Design Week this year is it's growing. It keeps getting bigger. It seems to really be starting to establish itself as a real event on the international calendar. I mean, we have over 100 exhibitions, installations, pop-ups throughout the city, concentrated in a few zones. Dozens of talks and workshops, people from all over the world, really great content. When we first started Beijing Design Week, we were not sure that what the response would be and whether the city was able to really pull off an event of this scale at a certain level of quality. And I have to say, Beijing really, really came through and stepped up to the plate. So I think they have a reason to be optimistic as well.
That was our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Liv Lewicznik, talking to Eric Chen there in Hong Kong. We're back in London next, talking tangling architecture and finding out what exactly that means after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving. For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Japanese architect Akihisa Hirata was one of the Japanese team that recently scooped the Golden Lion for Best Pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Far from taking a break after this success, he hot-footed it to London to unveil his first solo show, Tangling, at the Architecture Foundation. Alongside a series of intriguing drawings and models, the exhibition space is filled with a giant, contorted installation, a scale model that brings to life Hirata's extraordinary concept of tangling. Monocle's David Pleasant was joined in the studio by Hirata and the director of the Architecture Foundation, Sarah Ichioka, to hear what it's all about.
Tangling is a keyword for future ecological architecture. And I think in the nature, in the living world, everything is tangling. For instance, if you look at the ocean, fish roe is tangling on the seaweed, and seaweed is also tangling on an even rock in the ocean. So such kind of structure is always we can find out in the living world. And I'd like to make architecture as a part of such kind of order, and tangling is the keyword for that kind of architecture.
It seems clear that nature inspires your work, but you've made it clear that you're not copying nature in any way. You don't want to mirror exactly nature's structures. Can you explain a little bit about the difference that you see between the man-made and the natural and the relationship between the two?
I think to think about the roof, for instance, is very interesting because when you look from the sky, roof very look like a grand shape. The reason why they look similar is I think that roof is made to make the water flow. And the grand shape is made by the water flow. So behind the same shape is there's the same principle. Of course, roof is artificial things, and human being is making the roof. But the roof, in a sense, roof is made by the water flow. So such kind of relationship made us think of the artificial thing as a part of natural order. I'm very curious, if we look at architecture in that way, what will happen to us?
You've also talked a lot about trees in the exhibition and tree-ness. Mm-hmm. What's the inspiration behind trees?
Yeah, I was so inspired by the tree. For instance, imagine the people who is comfortable under the tree. But a tree is not thinking about the human being. They are just thinking of getting the maximum sunlight from the sun. On the other hand, human being feel comfortable under the tree. I think the ideal relationship between the human being and architecture should be something like that. Human being and the tree. The human being and the architecture.
Great. And Sarah, perhaps you could tell us a bit about the show itself. Could you talk us through this very kind of visual exhibition and 3D structure that we have there?
Absolutely. So Aki Sarata's office has worked very closely with AKT2 structural engineers to realize Sarata's design for a contorted self-supporting loop that fills our entire gallery space. And it's made of structural timber painted white, very kind of beautiful, pure, strong form, which directly, at a one-to-one scale of experimentation, illustrates Hirata's concept of tangled architecture. You feel your body constantly when you're walking through the installation. But that, in turn, forms a structure that, if I can borrow Hirata's vocabulary, further objects are tangled upon. So it's hundreds of models. Hang in a kind of barnacle-like way on this contorted loop, and each illustrate a different concept of Hirata's architecture. In many of the cases, they're kind of non-traditional models. They're models that show the design process in a very intimate and kind of generous way, I think. Things are left in that might normally be edited out of a show, but I think that's very much part of Hirata's design process.
Is there something that you feel we can learn from what's happening in Japan right now? Is there something that we can learn, architects over here in Europe?
Definitely. I mean, I would hesitate from generalizing completely about a national scene, but certainly when I hear Hirata talk about his work, I'm always impressed. Hirata and some of his accomplished peer group in Japan, how they always start from the principle of what architecture should be, big A architecture, but then also the little A architecture of the particular project they're working on, and not thinking about starting from what it shouldn't be, what it can't be, or what it will look like. It's very much about what it should do, what it should achieve, and using that as the generative point.
Finally, you've spoken somewhat about the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan and the opportunity that mm-hmm. has arisen or activated. Do you think that there's been a somewhat of a mind change within Japan, Japanese design and architecture since mm-hmm. that terrible natural disaster?
Mm-hmm. It's gradually happening, I think. For instance, we are doing a community house project in one damaged area, which is where it's totally damaged by the tsunami. So this, almost everything in the city center is disappeared. And they have to make something to reconstruct the society from almost zero state. And the other thing is about like Fukushima's accident. So I think the nature is not what we can control. Nature is maybe what we can tangle with. So based on such kind of modest feeling, we can maybe reconstruct the architecture and the city from the first.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant there, talking to Japanese architect Akihisa Hirata and Sarah Ichioka, director of the Architecture Foundation. Next up, I headed down to David Gill's spanking new gallery space in London's West End to meet a bit of a hero of mine. Italian designer Gaetano Pesce is as much an artist as a designer, and never someone to follow the follies and fancies of the design world. His latest collection, and first solo show in London, is called Six Tables on Water. True to their name, each table is a fully functioning resin structure that depicts a different type of watery environment, from the sea to a lagoon, a river to even a pavement puddle. I stole a few minutes with Gaetano Pesce to hear more.
First of all, I must say, it's David who said, Gaetano, why not an exhibition on tables? And then, because I don't do a simple functional object, I usually believe that the object have to express other things, not only practical qualities. And so I start to say what we can say with the table. Because I personally like water. My name is Fish. I like water. I had always, my places are always on water. In Venice, the house is on the water. In Brazil, I have a house on the ocean. So water is important. Then I start to think about that maybe not all the people respect water. There are some people who respect, some people who don't. Some people throw out garbage in the water. In Venice, one day in front of our house, I saw a bed
floating
in water. They threw out a bed. So some people are fragile in they behave, and so they do horrible things to water. But in the meantime, water is very precious and very important. We can all live without. So this story starts to say, okay, the table could be on water, talking about water. And some, like this one, is talking about a very pure water because the ocean is still very pure. And then from this, that was the second. And this one represents another kind of water, which is the lagoon. And because Venetian, there is a lagoon around Venice, and so it was a very easy for me to represent the lagoon in Venice. And because in this part of the lagoon down here, there is a chemical center where they do, I don't know, oil, I don't know what they do exactly, but in the old time, not today, but in the old time, they were discharging on the lagoon oil, and it was easy sometimes to see. Instead to see a clear water, you were seeing like oily water with blue, with the colors, etc. And so this is a representation of the piece of a lagoon in Venice that is a very shallow. And they do these kind of things to tell to the people that they go around with the boats that they have to stay inside these lines. Because if they go here, maybe there is
too shallow.
Not enough deep. And so this was easier for me because I know this place quite well. So and how it's done? It's done by layers. And so in a layer at the beginning, I put things like this, and then another layer to give a dip, then a little bit of sand, etc. Until in this thickness that you see here, that is done with a lot of layers, there are different representation.
And this resin surface is quite tough. It's possible to eat off it without scratching it?
Oh, if they treat well, it's not a problem.
I always say that everything scratches in life.
Diamonds scratch. If you see the table in wood that are old and where people used to eat several times, you see that they are quite damaged. But we say when they are damaged, they are very interesting because they are alive pieces.
They tell the story of the use. David, how did the tables end up in your gallery in the West End?
How did it end up here?
Yeah.
As Gaetano sort of said, it was an idea that of the exhibition, the tables, and for me it was a huge surprise because at some point in the process, I was called to come to New York, and they sort of said, before we go any further from this, I think you should come to New York and see how this is going to grow. And when I arrived, I had a huge surprise because there was the most beautiful lagoon, which it was beyond what I had hoped that Mr. Pesce would really create. And it was completely super excited. I sort of said, yes, this is more than I expected, and it's the best work I have seen of your life.
They are, you know, table is a typology that is more or less is minimal, you know, some other. And this is really an innovation of the table landscape nobody did before in history.
Work of art.
Yeah, in a certain way. Mm. Because if art is something who makes us, provoke us to think, provoke us to understand new values, etc., they are for sure provoking people to think, at least to think that we are supposed to treat water better. So this is very simple. So, there is nothing that I can say about the traditional way to treat design. No? When they say, look, it's very elegant, look, this line, perfect. Here there is nothing perfect. Here is just a work that it was done trying to understand the technique and making the object in the way it came out. But there is nothing related to perfection, related to, you know, execution that is fantastic. No, they are what they are.
And yet each one of them is a painting, is a sculpture. Yeah, yeah. When you look at each table, as we were talking about the scale of the table, you're standing in front of it, and yet you feel you are flying up, looking at a huge dimension, because it's a landscape, each one of them far away. And yet it's a surprising piece that is functional, and they're all very beautiful.
Mm. I'm surprised David was telling me that this is your first solo exhibition in the UK.
The way, in between, there is also this.
Yeah.
And for me, it's important, this opportunity that Peter David is giving to me, because it's my first time in England with my work. I did it with others, like Victoria and Albert, etc. But this is the first exhibition in my life. So at this age, that is, it's very close to the end.
No. It's the best time. It's the best time for Gaetano. It's the greatest.
It's true. It's true. You imagine the exhibition around the world.
But the energy never you have put in this work is incredible.
So thanks to this gentleman, finally this was done, and I am very, very glad for that.
Do you feel happy looking at them here?
Yes, because. What do you want to do? The story to make an exhibition with a lot of things, with a project. No, you come with the object, you put the object there. They talk very strongly. You don't need to do anything else.
Each piece is a real story, and it's really wonderful to look at.
That was me with the legendary Italian designer Gaetano Pesce at the opening of his new exhibition at David Gill's Gallery in London. If humanly possible, do make a trip to see his Six Tables on Water show. It is truly exquisite. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be discussing the best of British brands at a boutique trade fair in the capital. We'll be poking around Lisbon's less visited buildings at the city's first open house tour. And we'll be leafing through the giant pages of Fiden's exhaustive new graphic design compendium with Richard Spencer Powell too. Plus there's heaps more besides, so do tune in at 1900 hours London time on the 16th of October for all that. This week's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in honour of Stephen Bailey's wonderful analysis of all things a little bit less pretty, here's a suitable theme tune to go with his new book. This is Ugly by the Sugar Babes. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
When I was 7, they said I was strange. I noticed that my eyes and hair weren't the same.